So, it's time for some more hysterical literature. And this time we're moving on to chapter 3 of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover. Now, let's see how far through this one I can get. This looks to me possibly a bit longer than the other two, so we might end up having some issues. But we will see what happens. So, I'm just going to turn the toy on. And just sat here ready, just put it against the base of my cock. And we're ready to go. Connie was aware, however, of a growing restlessness. Out of her disconnection, a restlessness was taking possession of her like madness. It twitched her limbs when she didn't want them to twitch. It jerked her spine when she didn't want to jerk upright, but preferred to rest comfortably. It thrilled inside her body, in her womb, somewhere till she felt she must just jump into water and swim to get away from it. A mad restlessness. It made her heart beat violently for no reason, and she was getting thinner. It was just restlessness. She would rush off across the park, abandon Clifford, and lie prone in the bracken to get away from the house. She must get away from the house and everybody. The wood was her one refuge, her sanctuary. But it was not really a refuge, a sanctuary, because she had no connection with it. It was only a place where she could get away from the rest. She never really touched the spirit of the wood itself, if it had any such nonsensical thing. Vaguely she knew herself that she was going into pieces in some way. Vaguely she knew she was out of connection. She had lost touch with the substantial and vital world. Only Clifford and his books, which did not exist, which had nothing in them, void to void. Vaguely she knew, but it was like beating her head against a stone. Her father warned her again. "Why don't you get yourself a bow, Connie? All do you all the good in the world." That winter, Michaelis came for a few days. He was a young Irishman who had already made a large fortune by his plays in America. He had been taken up quite enthusiastically for a time by Smart Society in London, for he wrote Smart Society plays. Then gradually Smart Society realised that it had been made ridiculous at the hands of a down-at-heel Dublin street rat, and revulsion came. Michaelis was the last word in what was caddish and bounderish. He was discovered to be anti-English, and to the class that made this discovery, this was worse than the dirtiest crime. He was cut dead and his corpse thrown into the refuse can. Nevertheless, Michaelis had his apartment in Mayfair and walked down Bond Street the image of a gentleman, for you cannot get even the best tailors to cut their low-down customers when the customers pay. Clifford was inviting the young man of 30 at an inauspicious moment in that young man's career. Yet Clifford did not hesitate. Michaelis had the ear of a few million people, probably, and being a hopeless outsider, he would no doubt be grateful to be asked down to Ragby at this juncture, when the rest of the smart world was cutting him. Be grateful. He would no doubt do Clifford good over there in America. Kudos. A man gets a lot of kudos, whatever that may be, by being talked about in the right way. especially over here. Clifford was a coming man, and it was remarkable what a sound, publicly instinct he had. In the end, Michaelis did him most notably in a play, and Clifford was a sort of popular hero, till the reaction when he found he had been made ridiculous. Connie wondered a little over Clifford's blind, imperious instinct to become known. Known, that is, to the vast, amorphous world he did not himself know, and of which he was uneasily afraid. Known as the writer, as a first-class modern writer, Connie was aware from successful old, hearty, bluffing Sir Malcolm that artists did advertise themselves and exert themselves to put their goods over. But her father used channels ready-made, used by the other RAs who sold their pictures. Whereas Clifford discovered new channels of publicity, all kinds. He had all kinds of people at Ragby without exactly lowering himself, but determined to build himself a monument of a reputation quickly, he had used any handy rubble in the making. Michaelis arrived duly, in a very neat car with a chauffeur and a manservant. He was absolutely Bond Street, but at the right of him something in Clifford's country soul recoiled. He wasn't exactly, not exactly, in fact he wasn't at all well, what his appearance intended to imply. To Clifford this was final and enough. Yet he was very polite to the man, to the amazing success in him. The bitch goddess, as she is called of success, roamed, snarling and protective, round the half-humble, half-defiant Michaelis heels, and intimidated Clifford completely, for he wanted to prostitute himself to the bitch goddess success also, if only she would have him. Michaelis obviously wasn't an Englishman, in spite of all the tailors, hatters, barbers, booters of the very best quarter of London. No, he obviously wasn't an Englishman. The wrong sort of flattish, pale face and bearing, the wrong sort of grievance. He had a grudge and a grievance, that was obvious to any true-born English gentleman, who would scorn to let such things appear blatant in his own demeanour. Poor Michaelis had been kicked, so that he had a slightly tail-between-the-legs look even now. He had pushed his way by sheer instinct and sheer effrontery to the stage and to the front of it with his plays. He had caught the public and he had thought the kicking days were over. Alas, they weren't. They never would be, for he, in a sense, asked to be kicked. He pined to be where he didn't belong, among the English upper classes. And how they enjoyed the various kicks they got at him, and how he hated them. Nevertheless, he travelled with his manservant and his very neat car, this Dublin mongrel. There was something about him that Connie liked. He didn't put on airs to himself. He had no illusions about himself. He talked to Clifford sensibly, briefly, practically, about all the things Clifford wanted to know. He didn't expand or let himself glow. He knew he had been asked down to Ragby to be made use of, and like an old, shrewd, almost indifferent businessman, or big businessman, he let himself be asked questions, and he answered with as little waste of feelings as possible. "Money," he said. "Money is a sort of instinct. It's a sort of property of nature in a man to make money. It's nothing you do. It's no trick you play. It's sort of a permanent accident of your own nature. Once you start, you make money and you go on. up to a point, I suppose. But you've got to begin, said Clifford. Oh, quite. You've got to get in. You can do nothing if you're kept outside. You've got to beat your way in. Once you've done that, you can't help it. But could you have made money except by plays? Asked Clifford. Oh, probably not. I may be a good writer, or I may be a bad one. But a writer and a writer of plays is what I am. And I've got to be. There's no question of that. And you think it's a writer of popular plays that you've got to be? Asked Connie. There, exactly, he said, turning to her in a sudden flash. There's nothing in it. There's nothing in popularity. There's nothing in the public. If it comes to that, there's nothing really in my plays to make them popular. It's not that. They just are like the weather. The sort that will have to be for the time being. He turned his slow, rather full eyes, that seemed to have been drowned in such fathomless delusion, on Connie. And she trembled a little. He seemed so old, endlessly old, built up of layers of delusion, going down in him generation after generation, like geological strata. And at the same time, he was forlorn like a child, an outcast in a certain sense, but with the desperate bravery of his rat-like existence. At least it's wonderful what you've done at your time of life, said Clifford contemplatively. I'm 30. Yes, I'm 30, said Michaels, sharply and suddenly with a curious laugh, hollow and triumphant and bitter. And are you alone? Asked Connie. How do you mean? Do I live alone? I've got my servant. He's a Greek, so he says, and quite incompetent. But I keep him. And I'm going to marry. Oh yes, I must marry. It sounds like you're going to have your tonsils cut, laughed Connie. Will it be an effort? He looked at her admiringly. Well, Lady Chatterley, somehow it will. I find I can't marry an Englishwoman, not even an Irishwoman. Try an American, said Clifford. Oh, American! He laughed a hollow laugh. No, I've asked my man if he will find me a Turk or something. Something nearer to the Oriental. Connie really wondered if this queer, melancholy specimen of extraordinary success, it was said he had an income of $50,000 from America alone. Sometimes he was handsome. Sometimes, as he looked sideways, downwards, and the light fell on him, he had the silent, endearing beauty of a carved ivory negro mask. With his rather full eyes and the strong, queerly arched brows, the immobile, compressed mouth that momentarily but revealed immobility, an immobility and tirelessness which the Buddha aims at. Something old, old and acquiescent in the race. Aeons of acquiescence in race, destiny, instead of our individual resistance, and then a swimming through like rats in a dark river. Connie felt a sudden, strange leap of sympathy for him, a leap mingled with compassion and tinged with repulsion, amounting almost to love. The outsider. The outsider, and they called him a bounder. How much more bounderish and assertive Clifford looked. How much stupider. Michaelis knew at once he had made an impression on her. He turned his four hazel, slightly prominent eyes on her in a look of pure detachment. He was estimating her and the extent of the impression he had made. With the English, nothing could save him from being the eternal outsider, not even love. Yet women sometimes fell for him. English women too. He knew just where he was with Clifford. They were two alien dogs which would have liked to snarl at one another, but which smiled instead perforce. But with the woman, he was not quite so sure. Breakfast was served in the bedrooms. Clifford never appeared before lunch, and the dining room was a little dreary. After coffee, McAllis rested, and ill-sitting soul wondered what he should do. It was a fine November, a day fine for rugby. He looked over the melancholy park. My God, what a place. He sent a servant to ask, could he be of any service to Lady Chatterley? He thought of driving into Sheffield. The answer came, would he care to go up to Lady Chatterley's sitting room? Connie had a sitting room on the third floor, the top floor of the central portion of the house. Clifford's rooms were in the ground floor, of course. McAllis was flattered by being asked up to Lady Chatterley's own parlour. He followed blindly after the servant. He never noticed things or had contact with his surroundings. In her room, he did glance vaguely round at the fine German reproductions of Renoir and Cézanne. "It's very pleasant up here," he said, with his queer smile, as if it hurt him to smile, showing his teeth. "You're wise to get up to the top." "Yes, I think so," she said. Her room was the only gay modern one in the house, the only spot in Rugby where her personality was at all revealed. Clifford had never seen it, and she asked very few people up. Now she and McAllis sat on opposite sides of the fire and talked. She asked him about himself, his mother and father, his brothers. Other people were always something of a wonder to her, and when her sympathy was awakened, she was quite devoid of class feeling. McAllis talked frankly about himself, quite frankly without affection, simply revealing his bitter, indifferent, stray dog soul, then showing a gleam of revengeful pride in his success. "But why are you such a lonely bird?" Connie asked him again. And again he looked at her with his full, searching, hazel look. "Some birds are that way," he replied. Then, with a touch of familiar irony, "But look here, what about yourself? Aren't you by way of being a lonely bird yourself?" Connie, a little startled, thought about it for a few moments, and then she said, "Only in a way, not altogether like you." "Am I altogether a lonely bird?" he asked, with his queer grin of a smile, as if he had toothache. It was so wry, and his eyes were so perfectly, unchangingly melancholy, or stoical, or disillusioned, or afraid. "Why," she said, a little breathless, as she looked at him, "you are, aren't you?" She felt a terrible appeal coming to her from him that made her almost lose her balance. "Oh, you're quite right," he said, turning his head away and looking sideways, downwards with that strange immobility of an old race that is hardly here in the present day. It was that really made Connie lose her power to see him detached from herself. He looked up at her with the full glance that saw everything, registered everything. At the same time, the infant crying in the night was crying out of his breast to her in a way that affected her very womb. "It's awfully nice of you to think of me," he said. Lacedonically, "Why should I think of you?" she exclaimed with hardly a breath to utter it. He gave the wry, quick hiss of a laugh. "Oh, in that way, may I hold your hand for a minute?" he asked suddenly, fixing his eyes on her with almost hypnotic power, and sending out an appeal that affected her direct in the womb. She stared at him, dazed and transfixed, and he went over and kneeled beside her, and took her 2 feet close in his 2 hands, and buried his face in her lap, remaining motionless. Yes, she was perfectly dim and dazed, looking down in a sort of amazement at the rather tender nape of his neck, feeling his face pressing her thighs. In all her burning disarray, she could not help but putting her hand with tenderness and compassion on the defenceless nape of his neck, and he trembled with a deep shudder. Then he looked up at her with that awful appeal in his full glowing eyes. She was utterly incapable of resisting it. Fuck. From her breast flowed the answering, immense yearning over him. She must give him anything, anything. He was a curious and very gentle lover, very gentle with the woman, trembling uncontrollably, and yet at the same time detached, aware of every sound outside. To her it meant nothing except that she gave herself to him, and at length he ceased to quiver any more, and lay quite still, quite still. Then, with dim, compassionate fingers, she stroked his head that lay on her breast. When he rose, he kissed both her hands, then both her feet in their suede slippers, and in silence went away to the end of the room, where he stood with his back to her. There was silence for some minutes. Then he turned and came to her again, as she sat in her old place by the fire. "And now I suppose you'll hate me," he said in a quiet, inevitable way. She looked up at him quickly. "Why should I?" she asked. "They mostly do," he said. Then he caught himself up. "I mean, a woman's supposed to." "This is the last moment when I ought to hate you," she said resentfully. "I know, I know. It should be so. You're frightfully good to me," he cried miserably. She wondered why he should be miserable. "Won't you sit down again?" she said. He glanced at the door. "Sir Clifford," she said. Won't he be? She paused a moment to consider. "Perhaps," she said, and she looked up at him. "I don't want Clifford to know, not even to suspect. That would hurt him so much. But I don't think it's wrong, do you?" "Wrong? Good God, no. You're only too infinitely good to me. I can hardly bear it." He turned aside and she saw that in another moment he would be sobbing. "But we needn't let Clifford know, need we?" she pleaded. "It would hurt him so. And if he never knows, never suspects, it hurts nobody." "Me?" he said almost fiercely. "He'll know nothing from me. You see if he does. Me give myself away?" He laughed hollowly, cynically at such an idea. She watched him in wonder. He said to her, "May I kiss your hand? Or I'd go. I'll run into Sheffield, I think, and lunch there, if I may, and be back to tea. May I do anything for you? May I be sure you don't hate me? And that you won't... He ended with a desperate note of cynicism. No, I don't hate you, she said. I think you're nice. Ah, he said to her fiercely. I'd rather you said that to me than said you love me. It means such a lot more. Oh, fuck. Till afternoon, then. I've plenty to think about till then. He kissed her hands humbly and was gone. I don't think I can stand that young man, said Clifford at lunch. Why? Asked Connie. He's such a bounder underneath his veneer, just waiting to bounce us. I think people have been so unkind to him, said Connie. Do you wonder, and do you think he employs his shining hours doing deeds of kindness? I think he has a certain sort of generosity. Towards whom? I don't quite know. Naturally you don't. I'm afraid you mistake unscrupulousness for generosity. Connie paused. Did she? Was it just possible? Yet the unscrupulousness of Mika Michaelis had a certain fascination for her. He went whole lengths where Clifford only crept a few timid paces. In his way, he had conquered the world, which was what Clifford wanted to do. Ways and means. There were those of Michaelis more despicable than those of Clifford. Was the way the poor outsider had shoved and bound himself forward in person and by the back doors any worse than Clifford's way of advertising himself into provenance? The bitch goddess success was trailed by thousands of gasping dogs with lolling tongues. The one that got her first was the real dog among dogs. If you go by success, so Michaelis could keep his tail up. Queer thing was, he didn't. He came back towards tea time with a large handful of violets and lilies. Yes, fuck, and the same hangdog expression. Connie wondered sometimes if it was a sort of mask to disarm opposition, because it was almost too fixed. Was he really such a sad dog? His sad dog sort of extinguished self persisted all the evening. Though through it Clifford felt his inner effrontery. Connie didn't feel it, perhaps because it was not directed against women, only against men, and their presumptions and assumptions. That indestructible inward effrontery in the meagre fellow that was what made men so down on Michaelis. His very presence was an affront to a man of society. Cloak it as he might, in an assumed good manner. Connie was in love with him, but she managed to sit with her embroidery and let the men talk, and not give herself away. For as Michaelis was, he was perfect, exactly the same melancholic, attentive, aloof young fellow of the previous evening. Millions of degrees remote from his hosts. But laconically playing it up to them to the required amount, and never coming forth to them for a moment. Connie felt he must have forgotten the morning. He had not forgotten, but he knew where he was, in the same old place outside where the born outsiders are. He didn't take the lovemaking altogether personally. He knew it would not change him from an ownerless dog, whom everybody begrudges its golden collar, into a comfortable society dog. The final fact being that at the very bottom of his soul, he was an outsider. Oh, shit. Fuck. Fuck, let's go. And antisocial. And he accepted the fact inwardly, no matter how Bond Street-y he was on the outside. His isolation was a necessity to him, just as the appearance of conformity and mixing in with the smart people was also a necessity. But occasional love as a comfort, arid soothing, was also a good thing, and he was not ungrateful. On the contrary, he was burningly, poignantly grateful for a piece of natural, spontaneous kindness, almost to tears, beneath his pale, immobile, disillusioned face. His child's soul was sobbing with gratitude to the woman and burning to come to her again, just as its outcast soul was knowing he would keep really clear of her. He found an opportunity to say to her, as they were lighting the candles in the hall, "May I come?" "Oh, fuck. I'll come to you," she said. "Oh, good." He waited for her a long time, but she came. Yes. He was the trembling, excited sort of lover, whose crisis soon came and was finished. There was something curiously childlike and defenceless about his naked body, as children are naked. His defences were all in his wits and cunning, his very instinct of cunning. And when there was in ambivalence, he seemed doubly naked, like a child of unfinished tender flesh, and somehow struggling helplessly. Fuck. He aroused in the woman a wild sort of compassion and yearning, and a wild, craving physical desire. The physical desire he did not satisfy in her. He was always come and finished so quickly, then shrinking down on her breast and recovering somewhat his effrontery, while she lay dazed, disappointed, lost. But then she soon learned to hold him, to keep him there inside her when his crisis was over. And there he was generous and curiously potent. He stayed firm inside her, giving to her while she was active, wildly, passionately active, coming to her own crisis. Fuck. And as he felt the frenzy of her achieving her own orgasmic satisfaction from his hard, erect passivity, he had a curious sense of pride and satisfaction. "Ah, how good," she whispered. Tremulously, and she became quite still, clinging to him, and he lay there in his own isolation, but somehow proud. Fuck. Oh, fuck. He stayed the time only 3 days, and to Clifford was exactly the same as on the first evening. To Connie also. There was no breaking down his external man. He wrote to Connie with the same plaintive, melancholy note as ever, sometimes witty and touched with a queer, sexless affection. Oh, fuck. A kind of hopeless affection he seemed to feel for her, and the essential remoteness remained the same. He was hopeless and at the very core of him, and he wanted to be hopeless. He rather hated hope. un immense exasperans à la travis letter, he read somewhere, and his comment was, and it's darn well drowned everything worth having. Connie never really understood him, but in her way she loved him. And all the time she felt the reflection of his hopelessness in her. She couldn't quite love in hopelessness. And he, being hopeless, couldn't quite ever love at all. So they went on for quite a time, writing and meeting occasionally in London. She still wanted the physical, sexual thrill she could get with him by her own activity, his little orgasm being over. And he still wanted to give it to her, which was enough to keep them connected, and enough to give her a subtle sort of self-reassurance that something blind and a little arrogant. It was almost mechanical confidence in her own powers, and went with a great cheerfulness. She was terrifically cheerful at Ragby, and she used all her aroused cheerfulness and satisfaction to stimulate Clifford, so that he wrote his best at this time. Oh my God. Not far. And was almost happy in his strange, blind way. He really reaped the fruits of his sensual satisfaction. She got out of McAllis male, passively erect inside her. But of course, he never knew it. And if he had, he wouldn't have said thank you. Fuck. Yet when those days of her grand, joyful cheerfulness and stimulus were gone, fuck, quite gone, and she was depressed and irritable, how Clifford longed for them. Perhaps, if he'd known, he might even have wished to get her and McAllis together again. Fuck. Oh, fuck me. Wow, that was... fuck. Fuck. I only just fucking made that. Fuck. Well, I just made it to the end there, and fuck, that was so fucking close. That was the end of chapter 3. And I hope you'll come and join me for chapter 4. Oh.